Well, as we approach 27 minutes after the hour, we're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie's an Anglican. Should I call you a priest, Robbie? I mean, what's the formal title? Do you have?
It is. It's priest, okay. Pastor, rector, mm-hmm. which means ruler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is
yeah.
a weird thing to okay. be called.
Yeah.
Good to be with you, Jim and David.
You don't like carry a scepter Good around see you, Robbie. Or anything, do you?
Carry a what?
A scepter.
A scepter.
That just, no, okay. Leave that to the kings.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, that's a good context for Esther there, though. I see what you're working with.
I like the word pastor. He's an Anglican pastor, lives in Ashburn, Virginia, has his church there, and also happens to be the executive director at Preserving Bible Times, which we talk about frequently here. We enjoy their website and all the contents there. And if you're interested in biblical context, you've come to the right place this morning, because that's kind of what we dwell on here with Robbie. And we've been navigating through Luke for a number of weeks here. And we've arrived, David, at Luke 16. That's 1-6-16, David.
he's lost in the parables of lost things.
He got lost there. He's been on vacation recently, and it's still all coming back to him, you know?
What?
Well, we left Jesus with a crowd following him, including a bunch of Pharisees and scribes, and of course, his disciples probably physically were closest to him. And I'm reminded that in the original manuscripts, the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, there were no paragraphs. And correct me if I'm confusing it with Hebrew now, but I don't. In Hebrew, they write from right to left. And there's no punctuation, no paragraph breaks, so it's just like one mass text. I'm no Greek expert, but as far as I know in Greek, I've never been introduced to Greek punctuation to delineate sentences or spaces for paragraphs. So I'm thinking in the original, earliest manuscript of Luke, however old that is, this is one continuous reading, not broken into chapters. That came along like about the time of the printing press, didn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, what's important to note here is that we have segmented in our translation of the text. We have added chapter numbers, and of course, chapter headings, which it can be misleading.
Yes, they can.
Mm-hmm. Very misleading. And one of the most misleading chapter headings in some translations is the very next chapter, or later on in chapter 16, I should say, where the rich man and Lazarus. So if you're looking in more of a Catholic translation, it'll have the rich man and Lazarus. But if you look in more of a Protestant translation, a lot of Bibles will mischaracterize the rich man and Lazarus as a parable, and nowhere in that does it identify itself as a parable.
That's interesting. Interesting. The other thing those chapter headings do, though, can be detrimental to your own Bible study, because if you're looking for a topic or a subject, you flip through and you find it, and that's where you start. And you miss the context before that. I know Doug Greenwald always had excellent advice, says wherever you want, whatever verse you want to study, go back a chapter or even two chapters or three chapters and see what led up to that to inform you as to who those people were, where they were physically or geographically, what was going on. So as I understand this, we're in Galilee somewhere, and there are people from Judea there, Pharisees and scribes and experts in the law, as well as common folk who just want to hear Jesus. They know him by reputation, and of course his own disciples, his group of 12, who would be closest to him physically. In Luke 16, it simply starts with he told his disciples. So I'm mm-hmm. thinking they stopped walking, he turned around and he said, listen up guys, that kind of thing. That sound fair?
It does, and I'm going to add verse 14 to our conversation to kind of bookend what we're going to be talking today about, because we're going to be talking about 16, really the first half of 16. So you're correct, David. We've just finished the parables of the lost things. There's three of them, and it ends with Jesus directing his attention right at the Pharisees and the scribes. So the writers of the law, but also the teachers of the law. And so the older brother, that's their character. So it's the crescendo of this parable of the lost things, and the curtain closes, and we don't know if the older brother goes in to the celebration of the younger brother or not. And then verse 1 of 16 says, he said to his disciples, meaning Jesus is now speaking to his disciples, and in my Bible it switches red because I've got a red letter Bible here. But then after the parable of the unjust steward, and again, that's what this is titled, but this time it's correct. It's a correct title because Jesus is telling them a parable. And then at verse 14, it says, now the Pharisees were lovers of money, and they also heard all these things. So in other words, while Jesus is addressing his disciples, the Pharisees, the religious leaders, are in earshot. So this is intended for them as well.
And he's taking shots at them. This is the first I've heard. Maybe you mentioned this last week, though, that the older brother of the parable of the prodigal sons, that's the Pharisees' role in the story. And they would have recognized that.
Right.
The older brother failed in his responsibilities.
Yes. So this is the older brother who has the responsibility for the younger brother. And really, the younger brother, when he goes off to a far country, Doug Greenwald used to talk about that far country is code for the Decapolis.
Well, they talks about pigs. So
right.
Yeah,
so where do you find pigs? You're not going to find pigs in Jewish lands. You're going to find them in the Gentile lands. Mm-hmm. So these pigs are in the Decapolis, which means 10 cities, and that's a far-off country, and that's a land.
Southeast of the southeastern region on the shore of Galilee, yeah.
Exactly. So they would have been familiar. At night, when the winds blow from the southeast, it would actually blow in the sounds and the smells of revelry. So if you're a young man living in a Jewish town of, say, Bethsaida or Chorazin or Capernaum, where we know there is a synagogue in these places, there are synagogues in these places. If you're a young man growing up in a religiously devout family, very Jewish, these smells and these sounds would allure you.
I lived on a lake for 25 years, and David still does. And sounds and smells and everything come across a lake so easily. And sometimes we think of the Sea of Galilee as a huge body of water. It was not. It was a medium-sized lake by standards here. Mm-hmm. So thousands of pigs on the southeastern shore would have kicked up some dust. And I think everybody around Galilee would have known they were there and probably been totally repulsed by the idea of that part of the lake.
And celebrations, you know, mm-hmm. a pig roasting over a spit. I mean, those smells would come. The sounds of the celebrations and the revelry going on in Gentile territory. So Jesus tells this parable where, you know, he goes to this far-off country. The younger brother squanders the father's inheritance. And we start to see, in this case, it's the sinners. Remember, the tax collectors and the sinners are dining with Jesus. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees, Pharisees and the scribes don't think that they fall into this category of sinner. Mm-hmm. And so Jesus tells this parable to show them that they are horrible older brothers and that they are also prodigal and just want the father's stuff or not. The issue is, do you believe that the Gentile is your brother or not? Do you believe that this prodigal younger brother is indeed your brother? And you can think about this in the words of Paul in Romans, for I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes, to the Jew first, but also to the Gentile. So Jesus leads the parable with the prodigal, number one, being saved, and then the older brother, who we don't know if he receives the father's love.
It still seems like he turns his back, which should have stung the Pharisees miserably there.
Oh, yeah, because that's disrespect. In an honor-shame society, this older brother has disrespected his father more than once. Number one, he doesn't go look for his younger brother, and it's his job. Number two, he says, this son of yours, not this brother of mine. And number three, he doesn't go into the celebration. And he's dialoguing with his father, saying, you know, you didn't even give me a goat, and you give him the fatted calf. And you see this tension in the relationship. And the father says, son, all that I have is yours. You've been with me all this time, and don't you know that you have everything that's mine is yours? So in other words, what are you lacking in this scenario? But the older brother thinks that the father is giving away his wealth, his goods, even his birthright. And I made the connection last week that this story is echoing the story of Joseph and his brothers.
There's so much packed into the story of the prodigal sons, and that Jesus would have been saying to the Pharisees, in your conceit, in your narcissism, given your duties with respect to God the Father, you have failed miserably. You've turned your back. You have embarrassed him. You have shamed him by the way you have conducted yourselves.
Absolutely. So when Jesus says later in Luke chapter 19 in regards to Zacchaeus, the tax collector, and again, this parable is triggered by Jesus eating with tax collectors and sinners. Later, we see him doing it again at Zacchaeus's house. We know he's done it at Matthew's house. So Jesus is a habitual offender. He loves hanging out with sinners. And I don't know any kind of other people, frankly.
Just a side note on this, too. You mentioned Zacchaeus, and that's quite a story about he was the chief tax collector. He would have been reviled by the local population.
Right.
Later, and this is non-biblical now, but in other literature, he became the bishop in the Christian church in Caesarea.
I can't
verify that. It's church tradition,
or church history. Yeah. But in that chapter of 19, and we're going to get there as we're plugging along through Luke's gospel, because it is the gospel reading in the Anglican Church's lectionary. We're reading through Luke's gospel every week on Sundays, so that's kind of why we're camping out here. But verse 10 of chapter 19. Jesus says, for the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost. So I believe that's Jesus' mission statement, along with John 10:10, which says that I came that you might have life and that you might have life abundantly. The thief comes to kill, steal, and destroy, but I came to give you life. So take John 10:10 and pair it with Luke 19:10. And you've got the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which is lost. And all of us are lost. And that's the point of the parables of the lost things and why Jesus leaves it with the religious leaders needing to make a decision. Are you going to stay lost? Are you going to stay outside the celebration? Are you going to come in?
I can just see this group of people who've been following Jesus, including the scribes and the Pharisees and taxes, tax collectors and sin, the whole mixed bag with the disciples. I can see him turning around and moving on down the road just a little bit to give them time to savor what he just said. I mean, that had to be. Now, again, that's my presumption here. That's the way my mind is working, but I can't see him just nonstop talking like this. I think that this was a teaching at a very human pace, and this was not on studying the Bible online. This was teaching, and so they would have walked along a little bit, and then we get to Luke 16, where he must have turned around and addressed his disciples who were closest to him.
Right. So in terms of everyone else, I mean, we say it in our culture, he drops the mic and walks off the stage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so he does that. Jesus does, as you say, do kind of a bit of a mic drop here on the Pharisees and the religious leaders. But it doesn't mean they're not still lingering or paying attention, because, again, we see this in verse 14. Now, the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all these things. What are all these things? Well, the parable of the unjust steward. And that's what Jesus begins to tell his disciples.
In a voice loud enough for the Pharisees to hear.
Yeah. And we've all been there where we know someone's loud talking, and the reason they're doing is because they're not talking to the person they're talking to. They want everybody else to hear them. Mm-hmm. And there could be a little bit of that going. I mean, it's certainly speculation, but there could be a little bit of that going on. At least the text tells us they hear what he's saying. So we know that they are overhearing it, but Jesus may not be completely
Well, they were there to hear him. They're paying attention. They're not, although they may have muttered to themselves a little bit, those Pharisees, that group over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just trying to get the flavor of this interchange here.
Yeah, and I'm reading two really good commentaries. One is Chuck Missler's entire commentary on, it's 24 hours on Audible, on Luke's gospel. So Chuck Missler's got a commentary on all of Luke. He does an hour per chapter. And then Kenneth Bailey, while he isn't walking completely through Luke, he does address the parable of the unjust mm-hmm. steward. And he actually links the parable of the prodigal sons to the parable of the unjust steward. He's like, this is the rest of the story. In other words, this is what you are to do with your wealth. You are to leverage it for kingdom things.
And he would cover that. I think that's in Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes, Kenneth Bailey's book.
Yes, exactly.
Which I recommend to everyone. He is probably, we've lost him now. He's been gone for a few years. But probably the foremost authority on Middle Eastern culture and how they would have heard Jesus in Kenneth Bailey taught that. He's from Egypt originally. I just want to establish him as an authority. Yeah. Dr. Kenneth Bailey, you can find his stuff on Amazon.
And, yeah, he's excellent. Jesus, Poet, Peasant, and then the one that I'm kind of referencing loosely here, mm-hmm. which is Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes. And that's one of his only books that he has that you can pick up on Audible. And so if you're an audiobook person, that's a go-to book. The rest of them you'll have to get in hard copy or on PDF. But this is rich with cultural context. And if we don't understand the cultural context, well, first of all, even what little bit I do understand about the cultural context, this is one confounding piece of scripture, the first 14 verses.
It's always confused me. I'm all ears here.
Yeah, I've listened to the commentary, and I'm still afraid to touch it. Is this unjust steward being commended for lying? I mean, because this is what it sounds like. There was a certain rich man, so we can assume that this is the God character, the one who holds the wealth. Or if you want to link this to the parable of the prodigal sons, this is the father. Hmm. So you've got this rich man who has a steward. And this is what's important for all of us to realize. Just right here in verse 1, we are all renters. We don't own anything. A steward is someone who is managing someone else's resources. And in our North American kind of sensibilities, we're owners of property. We're individualistic. We want to know clearly what this is mine and this is yours, and I earn this, and you have no right to what's mine. And so we have this ownership mentality. But as followers of Jesus, as Christians, or even if you're Jewish, you're monotheistic, and we are as Christians as well, but if you're worshiping the Hebrew God of the Old Testament, and we do too as Christians, but if that's all you do and you don't adopt the New Testament, you know that all is God's. I mean, that's the way that 15 ends. Chapter 15 of Luke ends with the older brother. Don't you know that everything I have is yours? This is in the context of the older brother thinking that the father has given away his inheritance. In other words, he gave the younger brother the inheritance, and now anything else the father gives, the older son believes belongs to him. Like, that's my ring, that's my robe, that's my fatted calf. And the answer is no, this is mine. It's yours too, because you were stewards. I'm giving you access and rights to it. So this is almost seamless if you look at it through the lens of stewardship, or Genesis 1, where the earth is the Lord's and the fullness therein. In other words, God created all things, so therefore all things belong to him. In the beginning, God. So we're all renters now. Now this begins to make sense that we are stewarding God's resources. We don't own it.
You know, this reflects the way that people in Israel in the first century lived, so that they would relate to this instantly, that this notion of stewardship and not ownership, because my understanding is 90% of them were dirt poor. And they would live in maybe a small home or even on a hillside someplace, but they would work on land that was owned by somebody else. They were tenant farmers. So they were, in essence, stewards of somebody else's land. And they would have understood that concept innately.
Yeah. And that's the context for this parable. So in other words, when the unjust steward goes into the community and starts marking down everyone's debts, this is actually a common occurrence. In times of famine and hardship, the master, the owner, the landowner, who is renting out his space to the tenant farmers, will sometimes go and forgive in times of hardship their debts. And do you know what happens? His popularity skyrockets. And everybody loves the landowner when he begins to mark down debts. They say, thank you so much. And they're realizing that they've been extended a grace. So when this unjust steward realizes that he hasn't pleased his master and he's gotten his walking papers, in other words, you're fired. Collect, give me your books and let me see an accounting of what you've been doing. Now, in our corporate world, the head of HR and security would come to your office and walk you out the building, and you would not have the opportunity to do anything. And I've seen this happen in various places of employment, and it doesn't look like this. It's interesting that this man has been told he's out of here, and he's still given authority. So he goes and marks down everybody's debt. So now two things happen. Number one, they owe him one. And number two, it elevates the master's popularity. So everyone now loves the master. So the master's in a dilemma. If he says, no, you still owe me the full amount, he is now going to fall out of his newly earned good graces. But also, there's just been a huge influx of cash because everybody's saying, great, I'll pay that lesser debt in a heartbeat, you know? And so they're happy about this situation.
Was this sedition, a subterfuge on the part of the shrewd manager? He really is a shrewd manager. He's been fired, and now he sets up his boss. Or is this about forgiveness?
Well, it really is, and we have to see this, that it really is a win-win on the side of both the boss and the shrewd steward, because now if the boss does fire him, I mean, that's the other thing. What does the boss do with him now? What does the landowner do? Does he say, oh, wait a minute, I changed my mind. That was a pretty cool trick you just did.
You're smart enough to stay.
Yeah.
I need you now.
Second thought, I think you've learned your lesson, and you're starting to behave, you know, like a true businessman. And the application for us as the hearers, and it says it in the parable, by the way, he who is faithful over a little will be made faithful over a lot. If you can't get it right with worldly goods, God's never going to trust you with kingdom goods. In other words, the children of the earth, the people of the world, know how to work with excellence, and you don't? And so we really see a turnaround in this unjust steward. We don't know what happens to him. And the hinge really is verse 8. It says, so the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light.
And I wonder if the word shrewd is the best translation there.
Yeah.
That jumps out. Or would wise.
Right. Well, think about this. I mean, this is a confounding verse that you would be familiar with. And I think that it plays into it. It's actually Luke chapter 16. Oh, sorry. 16:8 I just read. Mm-hmm. It's actually Matthew 10:16, behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. That's Jesus's words to his disciples, commending them, saying, I'm sending you out into this world in the midst of wolves. You need to be as wise as serpents and as innocent as doves. So, wait a minute. Isn't the serpent the one who caused the fall in Genesis?
An evil figure, yeah.
So Jesus is saying all of a sudden, I'm supposed to be as wise as the serpent?
See, there's where we need the context, because maybe the word serpent didn't mean to them what it means to us.
Well, certainly it's a symbolic of a crafty figure or a crafty person, someone who is shrewd or wise. But this is an example of interpreting the scripture with the scripture. And I would add another one where there's an unjust judge and the persistent widow that goes to him. It's like, wait a minute. Jesus is saying be persistent with God. Is God the unjust judge? And the point is, no, he's not. But if an unjust judge is going to change his mind with a persistent prayer, so will a loving God. So how do we see God, or how do we see the landowner here? He's not going to dishonor himself. So if he's been honored by the shrewdness of the serpent, the servant, and he's been forgiven all these debts, then he is not going to give up that honor to hold them accountable to their original debts. So the unjust steward kind of wins the day here, and Jesus commends him, saying we should be like this person in our dealings in the world with spiritual things.
Is that the message to the Pharisees in this as well?
Well, again, who are they in the parable? And if Jesus is addressing this to his disciples, which part of this does he hope he will get, that they will get out of it? Because again, verse 14 says that they are standing by and they hear what is happening. The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, also heard these things, and they derided him. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your heart. For what is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God." So how are they leveraging their goods? Are they the ones that are leveraging it for the master's benefit, for mutual benefit, or just for their own benefit? That's the question.
Well, they take part of the sacrifice. They make their living with temple. Well, not all Pharisees were like that, but in the Jerusalem establishment, where these people were probably from, were a corporate entity with the temple, and their primary business was making money. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, they're lovers of money for that reason, because it is pay-to-play religion, and they are financially benefiting from their dealings. The question, I think, is are the people also benefiting? So in other words, if you go back to the parable and those are the debtors that owe the master that now have their debt marked down, they are benefiting. Are the people benefiting from the Pharisees' dealings?
So there's where maybe forgiveness fits in here.
Yeah, it's a confounding passage. But one of the things that I take from it, again, is that application from Matthew's gospel that we are to be as innocent as doves and as shrewd as serpents. So, in other words, if the world is good at business, we as followers of Yahweh or followers of Jesus should be better at business. If the world is that good, we should be even better. And I think that a lot of times our excellence does not match the excellence of world, what's going on in the world, and it should.
Agreed. Interesting. Luke 16, and we have yet to go to... Now, here's where those chapter headings are just a downright irritation to me. It just says additional teachings. It's like afterthoughts in Luke 16. When he talks about the law and the prophets, and he talks about a divorced wife and so forth. Can we get into that next week?
Well, if I'm with you all next week, it'll be
yeah, that's true.
You'll Ridgecrest.
Oh, you're going to be at Ridgecrest. Yeah, New Wineskins Conference, and that's an Anglican conference specifically, is it not?
It's an Anglican Missions Conference near Asheville, North Carolina, New Wineskins Conference, Ridgecrest Conference Center, and Preserving Bible Times will be presenters there at our table in the exhibitor booth, and we're already on the virtual booth. So if you're signed up for New Wineskins Conference, if you know what that is and you have the app, visit us either on our virtual booth or in person at New Wineskins next week.
Outstanding. Well, we'll hope to hear from you, but if not, we know you're working hard all the same. Robbie Pruitt, Anglican pastor, executive director of Preserving Bible Times. Their website, by the way, preservingbibletimes.org. To spell it all out, no spaces, preservingbibletimes.org. A wealth of contextual teachings there, both written and in video form. And even an audio book or two. So they're in the process of converting all the old physical materials into streaming materials, which makes them exceptionally easy to work with. PreservingBibleTimes.org. Robbie,
Did your church dried out yet, Robbie?
What's that?
Did your church dried out yet?
Yeah, you're not flooded, fixed up. Dried out, but not fixed up.
Ah, okay. A little flooding.
Robbie's church had some flooding here about a month ago. Thanks. So,
good to be with you, Jim and David. Thanks for having me on.
Robbie,
good
take care. Travel safely.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.